begin with now taking a look at the next judge. We talked about Othniel very, very briefly. This is not a Bible. Yes, it is a Bible. Okay. Since I forgot to bring mine in, I'll use this one since it's been left by somebody. That after Deborah's activities, using Barak, of course, to carry out the military activities, it's interesting the state of the nation at that time, the time of Deborah, that when she gave him the command from God to gather these forces to Mount Tabor so that God could deliver the Canaanites into his hand, he said very bravely, "If you will go with me, I will go." I find that rather interesting because the word Barak in Hebrew, which was his name, means lightning, and he was anything but lightning in responding to this challenge. But apparently stiffened by Deborah's willingness to trudge up the mountain with him, he went ahead and got the forces together. And of course, God gave them into their hand, and the land then secured rest. Okay, let's see now what happened here. This is interesting the way this is divided up. Bible is it? I don't know. Oh, Scofield reference. Okay. We read a rather unusual statement at the beginning of chapter 6. I hope you all know we're in the book of Judges. Well, it has been a long weekend. And the children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Eternal, and the Eternal delivered them into the hand of Midian for 7 years. Now, this particular oppression by the Midianites was very different from the oppression that they had been under, first from the Cushan Rishathaim, and second by Eglon, king of Moab, and third by the Canaanite kings of the north under the leadership of Jabin, because the Midianites were not the same kind of community that the other peoples were. And this is indicated right here in the chapter, the kind of people that they were, when we see that they, in verse 5, they came up with their cattle. I mean, how many invaders come up with their cattle? That's not the usual procedure. And their tents, you see. And it mentions here not only that they're numerous, how numerous they were, but they and their camels were without number. You see, and they entered the land not to dominate it, not to control it, but to destroy it. So you have a totally different kind of oppression in this particular case, as is brought out by the scripture. And you've got people who are more nomadic type people who are coming in and oppressing Israel. Now, what kind of oppression did these nomadic people visit upon Israel to the point that you see the result of their pressure in verse 2? That the hand of Midian prevailed against Israel, and because of the Midianites, the children of Israel made themselves dens, which were in the mountains, and caves, and strongholds. Obviously, they inspired a great deal of fear in the Israelites, and are we to assume, therefore, that the Israelites lived all the time in caves in the mountains, and dens in the mountains, and didn't live in their villages anymore, but they abandoned them, and they abandoned their fields? And the answer, of course, is no. Is that they built these things as places of refuge to flee to when the Midianites came up over the horizon. And when did they come up over the horizon? Just haphazardly or in some special time of the year? In verse 4, we read, "They encamped against them and destroyed the increase of the earth." Now, what do we mean by increase of the earth? Dan? Yeah. So what season then are we talking about? Now the harvest season. It might not have only been just fall. Remember, Canaan is blessed with more than one harvest season. We have a smaller harvest in the spring, which culminates, of course, in early summer. Actually, two different crops, one ripening before the other, one requiring a little more rain to ripen and be reaped. That's why you have the Passover harvest, and then you have the Pentecost harvest, and you have, of course, the great fall harvest. So these were the times of the year that they would have come into the land. And notice the degree to which they rampaged about. As it says, they destroyed the increase of the land, of the earth, until you come to Gaza. Now, again, that's a geographical reference, but we need to appreciate, you know, this flow of these people as much as we can, because that will tell us why certain tribes were involved in assisting Gideon in the relief and other tribes were not. Because again, you know, when we see that term Israel, we must beware that we don't assume too much. As we will see today also in another reference where it talks about Israel and it means a very restricted part of Israel. I'll give a little light on this. Where did the Midianites come from? Where did they come in from? Where does it say they came in from? Do you have any indication of the direction at which or point at which they entered the country? Very good. So if they entered from the east, they had to cross the Jordan River. And of course, we are left wondering where they did. And the answer is to the point at which they entered is given to us after the actual military activity that Gideon launches against them, when we find that confronted by the military efforts of Gideon as amplified by God, they fled. We find the direction in which they fled. If you turn the last part of chapter 7 and getting into chapter 8, you find the direction in which they fled. You'll notice that Gideon had sent messengers that they should take the fords of the Jordan to block off their escape. But they, some of them managed to get across the Jordan. And as it says, Gideon, in verse 5 of chapter 8, came to Sukkot and asked for some assistance because he was in hot pursuit of the Midianites. And then he proceeded to Penuel, where he made a similar request, and then finally caught up with them further on past the point of Penuel. Now, across the Jordan here, you have the Jabbok River that comes in, that bisects the area of Gilead, that enters the Jordan at this particular point. And you have Sukkot right at the point where the hills of Gilead come to an end in the plain, in the valley of the Jordan. And then we have Penuel located further up the valley of the Jabbok. And so we can see that this is the way they are retreating. This is the way they are seeking to return to their own main encampment, where Gideon later confronts them and sort of conducts a mop-up operation. And so that tells us very clearly the direction from which they came. They came in from the area of Gilead, down the Jabbok Valley, across the Jordan, and where would they logically head from here? To the Jezreel Valley. Because, of course, this is an area where they can do a lot of their raiding, and also it gives them deep access to the country. And once they, and actually the actual battle began near Mount Moriah, which is located right here in the Jezreel Valley, as we'll see when we read the account in a little while. And it says they raided as far as Gaza. Now, how would one get from here to Gaza? What route would one follow? Right. One would pass by Megiddo through the Aruna Pass and go right down the Via Maris to Gaza. And so you see, they use the natural routes of the day for their activities, I mean the main routes of travel. But now, what tribes would have been most affected by their activity? What tribes would, you know, have felt the problem? If we look at Gideon's, we jump ahead for a minute and look at Gideon's experience at Sukkoth and Penuel, that gives us a clue. Again, in chapter 8, verse 5, here Gideon is in hot pursuit of the Midianites, and he and his troops, of course, have not had a whole lot of provisions with them, and so they're very hungry. And so he says to the men of Sukkoth, "Give, I pray you, loaves of bread to the people who follow me, for they are faint. And I am pursuing after Zeba and Zalmunna, the kings of Midian." And notice the response of the princes of Sukkoth. The princes of Sukkoth said, "Are the hands of Zeba and Zalmunna now in your hand that we should give bread to your army?" What kind of an answer is that? What does that mean? Translate that into 20th century Americanese. Jim?
What if they didn't win and then they came back on that town because they
lost their home? Yeah. You say, have you already defeated them and removed the possibility of retaliation from us that we should give you assistance? Why should we run the risk of offending these Midianites and they'll turn upon us? And so obviously they are concerned because they have been know what to expect from these people. By the way, it says, "Are the hands of Zeba and Zalmunna now in your hand?" That's not just a poetic phrase. That is meant, in this case, to be taken literally. You see, that's usually, in this particular period of time, the way one counted up the enemy dead. You went through the battlefield, and when you came to the body of a dead enemy, you cut off his right hand. And you then counted the right hands that were piled up in a pile. I mean, this was a typical Egyptian practice of the day. And that's where the expression comes from. I don't know for sure if the Israelites carried out the same procedures or not, but it was common practice of the Egyptians, who, of course, had been a force in Canaan for a long period of time, that this is what was traditionally done at the end of a battle, where they had secured a victory. And so that's where that particular phrase comes from. That's what it particularly refers to. So these people were feeling the oppression. Okay, what other tribes would have been feeling the oppression if this is an area where the Midianites were wont to invade? What tribes do we have living in this area? Remember I said you needed to begin to familiarize yourself with what tribes were where. Okay, Manasseh, located just in this section here, just adjacent to the Jezreel Valley, as well as across in Gilead itself, we have the tribe of Manasseh. Well, let's not just yell them out. Let's try to be recognized first. Matt? Issachar, located right here. What else?
Naphtali
would have been up here, but perhaps their southernmost people would have been feeling the pressure. That's true. Who would have felt the pressure as they came down here? What tribe? Well, Benjamin is located too far to the south, really, and all the way up in the hills. So Benjamin would not have felt any of this pressure. And Judah would not have felt any of this pressure. You see, but Ephraim would have. So you see, we have, and what tribe do we have here living in this area of the Jezreel Valley?
Dan.
No. Dan lives down here and up here. That's why the Danites would not be feeling this pressure either, you see. But Zebulun lives in this area. And so, keeping in mind which tribes would have felt the pressure, we will consider later which tribes actually provide soldiers for fighting the Midianites. And you will see that there's a logical connection, you see. In other words, when the Bible tells us that certain tribes lent their efforts in response to Gideon's appeal for soldiers and other tribes failed to send anybody, we should relate that to which tribes were involved in feeling this pressure and which tribes were not. Because geographically, it's just what we would expect. in terms of his response. Okay, let's now that we have an understanding of the nature of the oppression, the areas that felt the oppression, and which tribes felt the pressure, let's take a look at Gideon, the servant who God called out to be the instrument of deliverance. And again, remember, we're trying to concentrate on three things. We're trying to concentrate, you know, on not only which tribes are involved in feeling the pressure and are involved in relieving that pressure, but also in terms of the judge, we're trying to keep in mind from what strata of society the judge comes. And I forgot now. Not only the strata he came from, but also which tribe. That's right, which tribe he came from. So we can get a composite picture. Okay. We find here that in verse 11, going back to chapter 6, beginning in verse 6, that Israel was greatly impoverished because of the Midianites, and the children of Israel cried to the Eternal. Well, certainly the people that were afflicted cried. I don't think we should assume that those that were not afflicted also cried out to God, but those who were afflicted did. And it came to pass, when the children of Israel cried out to the Eternal because of the Midianites, that the Eternal sent a prophet to the children of Israel, who said, "Thus says the Eternal God of Israel, I brought you up from Egypt, brought you forth out of the house of bondage, delivered you out of the hand of the Egyptians and out of the hand of all who oppressed you, and drove them out from before you and gave you their land. And I said, I am the Eternal your God. Don't fear the gods of the Amorites in whose land you dwell." In other words, don't fear them that you therefore feel you have to serve them. Which is, of course, what Israel had done. Israel said, look, we're living in the land of Canaan. How can we expect to prosper here unless we take recognition of the gods of Canaan? You see, if we ignore them, they will be wrathful towards us. Therefore, we better serve them as well. And God had said, look, don't fear them. But you have not obeyed my voice. Now, we have sort of a break in the action, because this is where this conversation, at least the reporting of it, comes to an end. And we sort of have a change of scene. Sort of like a curtain comes down, and the curtain comes up again on the next scene in verse 11. And there came an angel of the Lord and sat under an oak, which was an Ophrah, that pertained to Joash the Abiezrite and his son Gideon, who threshed wheat by the winepress to hide it from the Midianites. Now, why is he threshing wheat in a winepress? Yeah, he was losing a bit of shrewdness. It was not the wine harvest, so the Midianites would not be interested in the wine presses, and therefore he could be threshing the wheat there in a place where they wouldn't expect to find him. Instead of out in the open on the threshing floors, he'd be hidden in this wine press, because you see, parts of the wine press, of course, are in a depression. You see, it wouldn't be quite as visible. Now, the angel of the Eternal appeared to him and said, "The Eternal is with you, you mighty man of valor." And Gideon probably looked all around to see who else was with him. Doesn't seem like it's very brave to be hiding there in the wine press. But you know, they're all degrees of bravery. Where were all the other Israelites? In the caves and the dens. They weren't out harvesting their wheat. They had abandoned it to hide and save themselves, and abandoned the wheat to the will of the Midianites, you see. Gideon, at least, was trying to bring in a harvest. Even if he was using subterfuge, he was at least a bit braver than the others. And maybe that's why God picked him, because he was the only one that showed even a little bit of bravery. Well, Gideon said, "Oh, my Lord, if the Eternal would be with us, why is all this happening to us? Where are all his miracles which the fathers told us about?" You know, that's an old complaint. Unless people have experienced personally miracles, they sometimes find it difficult to believe there ever were such, because they have lack of personal experience. "But now the Eternal has forsaken us and delivered us into the hands of the Midianites." And the Eternal looked upon him and said, looked upon Gideon, go in this your might, and you shall save Israel from the hand of the Midianites. After all, haven't I commissioned you? And Gideon said, well, if that's the case, how can I lose? When do I start? No, he says, oh, my Lord, how can I save Israel? How can I be used as an instrument to motivate and lead the forces of Israel when my own family is poor in Manasseh? And even in my own family, I am the least important. I am an insignificant person in my father's house, which is not a poetic term, it's a technical term. It refers to a division of a clan. He says, I am the least significant person in my father's house, and my father's house is considered to be of no account in the tribe of Manasseh. Certainly, you mistook the quarter to which you have come. You were looking for the wealthy part of town where the leaders are, and you took a wrong turning on the way in. You turned left at the city gate when you should have turned right. You see, he has a feeling that leaders come from the leadership cadre. That's what's natural. But God has chosen otherwise in this instance. The Eternal said to him, surely I will be with you. And because of that, you shall smite the Midianites as one man. So Gideon finds it still a little hard to believe that this is really meant to be. Reminds me of that Cockney in London. Did I tell you the story about the Cockney in London? Bus driver. I told you that story. We were on a tour of London by bus, and we didn't hire a guide. We just had our bus driver, who was a Cockney. And he asked me, since I was in charge of the group, he said, would you like me to give sort of a commentary as we go around? I thought, well, why not? I mean, I was going to do it, but he probably knows it better than I do. Fine. And he gave us a superb commentary as we drove around London. It was amazing how much he knew about London, and he did it in such an interesting way that everybody was having a fantastic time. And at the end of the day, I said to him, you know, I'm really curious. You did such a fantastic job. You were so interesting to listen to, and you knew so much about London. And why is it that you've never tried to become a guide? I would assume guides, you know, earn more than drivers, and of course they earn more in tips if they're good than drivers do. And he said, well, that would be above me. It was his answer. That he was of a certain class, and to have aspired to be a guide would be reaching above his station in life and be unseemly. And so he hadn't done it. And I felt so devastated that his concept of class so played such a tyrannical role in his life, it limited his aspirations. Now, in America, that's not that common, though in the ghettos, I think it rather is. And one reason why some people don't try to do more is because they don't believe that they can. You know, that why bother if it's only going to end in failure? But this was not just a doubt of their own worth, it was just being improper for him to do so, which is a very unfortunate thing. I think that's what we see here with Gideon in his initial refusal. He says, you know, I'm not of that leadership upper strata of society. I mean, who am I to do this, you see? This is working in his mind as well as his own fears. They're both there. But I think both are working in his mind. So he says, if I have found grace in your sight, show me a sign that, you know, that this is really what you mean, that I'm not misinterpreting this. And he says, first, of course, he goes and gets a kid and some unleavened cakes, and he presents it, you know, as an offering here. And after that has been taken care of, he indicates the nature of the sign that he would like. We come down here. Where is this here now? My eyes are not lighting on it. I want to skip over this matter of the altar of Baal, which he destroys. Thank you. Yeah. He says, I will put this fleece of wool on the ground, and if the dew be on the fleece only, and it be dry upon all the earth beside it, then I will know that you will save Israel by my hand, because it's common that when the dew coats the ground, it coats everything. So he says, look, if the fleece is wringing wet and the dry ground is dry, I'll know that that's obviously a miracle, and that indicates, you know, that I'm supposed to do this. And it was so, for he rose early on the next day and thrust the fleece together and wrung the dew out of the fleece, a bowl full of water. And then Gideon said, let not your anger be hot against me, but let me speak one more time. But could you do this thing one more time, only do it the opposite way? Let the fleece be dry and the ground be wet. And of course he had it as he had designated, and then of course had his doubts considerably removed. So it took a lot to stir him up. I mean, what kind of a people are so oppressed that they, you know, have such doubts? I mean, this is a reflection of the feeling of despair, I think, that the people were feeling. They had absolutely no confidence at all, and of course Gideon had very little, and partly, I think, because of his station as well. Okay, what did Gideon do in relieving the oppression? Well, he gathered the tribes together, all of them, all 12, right? Isn't that what it says? Or is it what it says? No, it doesn't say he gathered all the tribes together. It says here, backing up in chapter 6 to verse 33, that all the Midianites and the Amalekites and the children of the east were gathered together, and they went over and encamped, meaning they went over the Jordan, and encamped in the valley of Jezreel. And the Spirit of the Eternal came upon Gideon, and he blew a trumpet, and Abiezer was gathered after him. Now, Abiezer was his own clan. When we go back earlier in the chapter and take a look again at his family relationships, in verse 15, verse 11, you find that his father is Joash, and his father is called an Abiezerite. That means he's in the clan of Abiezer, which is a clan in the tribe of Manasseh. So it's interesting that his own clan, of course, is willing to follow him when he blows the trumpet. And which other tribes are gathered to him? Notice what he does in verse 35. He sent messengers throughout all Manasseh, who also were gathered to him. And he sent messengers to Asher, to Zebulun, and Naphtali, and they came up to meet him. Now, these are then the tribes. I'm sorry that Asher is missing from there. We can presume Issacharite involvement because of the oppression being on them. But it's Manasseh that he relies on most heavily, his own tribe. You see, there was not a willingness of other tribes to just naturally, as a matter of fact, accept the leadership of somebody from another tribe. It's not surprising that he sent his messengers first to his own clan, and then to his own tribe, and then only began to extend it beyond that. This is just the nature of the life in which they lived. Now, how did they go about proceeding? Here again is a map of the Valley of Jezreel. We have the Hill of Moreh mentioned. Is that in focus? Yeah, okay. We have the Hill of Moreh, which is in this part of the Jezreel. Mount Gilboa is the northernmost part of the hills of Samaria. Manasseh is located here. Asher, Zebulun, and Naphtali are in this direction. So he gathers these people, and where does he gather them to? He is told to gather them to the spring of Harod, which is located on the southern edge of the Jezreel Valley, right at the foot of Mount Gilboa. The Midianites are just across this part of the valley on the hill of Moreh. And this is where God sets a test. Remember the test? God said, look, if you take all these thousands of men into battle, you'll think that it was the thousands that gave you the victory. And I want you to learn the lesson that it's me that has given these people into your hand. And so therefore, you will only take with you those people who, when they drink from the spring, drink in a certain fashion. This is the spring. It comes out from the foot of Mount Gilboa, and it still produces a great deal of water year-round. And depending on how they drink from the water of this spring, that will determine how many people you take. And it was only 300 people that drank from the spring in the approved manner. And it was with these 300 that Gideon had to go into battle. Now this spring, which is back there in the cave, produces a stream, which, as you can see in this artificial pool, has been collected and then continues to flow through the rest of the Jezreel Valley. Now, let's take a look at the technique that was used by Gideon with his 300 men, obviously under the direction of God. And what do we notice about the technique? This is sort of a sidelight, but it's interesting to stop and admire some of these things in passing. First of all, what is the timing of the attack? It's a night attack. This is something very unusual in the Old Testament period. People did not fight battles at night. You camped, and then after sunrise, you went into action. You just didn't engage in major attacks at night. It just was not done. Now, somebody has told me, and I don't have any way of checking, or I have a way, I guess, I just haven't taken the time to do it, that there was a superstitious belief that if one died during the nighttime in a battle, that one's soul suffered some disabilities that it would not have suffered if you'd have died in battle during the daytime. And that may account for the fact that they didn't engage in nighttime battles, that this being a superstition of the period. I don't know if that's true. I've heard about that in connection with the Indians in America, but I've never heard about it in connection with the Old World. So I can't tell you for sure if that was a reason. But Gideon's attack is a night attack, and at what particular point in the night was he instructed to attack? What does it tell us in the text? Yes, at the beginning of the middle watch. Now, why is that the most advantageous time? Gary? Right, the second watch, what had they probably been doing before they assumed duty? So they're just sort of rubbing the cobwebs out of their eyes. And what about the first watch? What condition would they be in as they're going off duty? Ken? Yeah. So you see, you've got them at a particularly vulnerable point in time, you see, in this kind of a situation. As in many instances, the biblical descriptions, you know, deal with realities. And they, in a sense, that they give you all the flavor of the event, showing you, you know, the human dimension to it. So this is the most vulnerable time. And what was the method by which they attacked? Did they just start swinging their swords right and left, or what was going on here? Mr. Kustin. Right. And so they broke their pitchers and they blew on their trumpets. And of course, with all the lights and noise, remember, he divided his company up into three groups. So they came on the camp from three different directions. And then with the breaking of the pitchers and blowing of the trumpets, there was a frightful noise, you see. And with the lights and everything, the Midianites were naturally enormously confused as to how many people were really attacking them. And they began to assume that the enemy had already penetrated, was in the camp. And they began fighting each other, thinking they were fighting the enemy. So there was a tremendous amount of confusion. Which, of course, God amplified that, because it's not only Satan that can, of course, move people through emotion, but God can too. And obviously heightened that sense of panic and so forth that resulted in this horrible melee in which many Midianites killed each other. And then, of course, as a result of that panic, the remaining Midianites fled. Now, Gideon, after he had surrounded their camp near on the other side of the hill of Moreh and had inflicted this kind of a panic in them, the Midianites fled towards the Jordan River. Now, they weren't about to just throw themselves pell-mell into the river. They would naturally go to the river at particular points where it was easy to cross it, at the natural fording places of the river. And so this is what Gideon, of course, did is he had sent messengers, as we read, to the people of Ephraim that they should come down and take the fording places of the Jordan between these two points, all the likely fording places, to cut off the possibility of many Midianites escaping. And apparently that did work because very few Midianites got across. Then, of course, Gideon continued on in hot pursuit after the remaining ones and conducted his mop-up operation, which we, and of course, encountered the resistance at the cities of Sukkot and Penuel. Again, I think the incident at Sukkot and Penuel illustrates a point, that you didn't automatically get cooperation with the leadership. There was nothing in the system of that day that there was an organized looking towards the leader and accepting his authority and carrying out his commands. That even a leader had to sort of scrounge around for support. That not only don't we have all the tribes coming up to answer this need, but also we find that even cities that are themselves involved in the need don't necessarily give their support to the leader. This is an age where it was very, very difficult to be a leader in Israel. Many of us are familiar with the story of the Levite and his concubine, who was abused at Gibeah of Benjamin. What did he do with the dead body of his concubine? Rather gruesome thing, but let's consider it in this light. Susan? That sounds like a very gruesome type of thing to do, to summon them to joint action. But you see, it took something like that to stir up the tribes to any kind of joint action. It wasn't common to engage in joint action. It took sort of an extreme situation. Of course, there was symbolic language in that, but in essence, the same will be done to you if you don't come. And if you look ahead a bit, you may want to do a comparison in chapter 11 of 1 Samuel. You find Saul, the first time he goes into action to fight an enemy of Israel as king, he does a similar thing, only he uses his oxen. But again, he has to resort to extreme pressure to bring about united common action from the tribes, because there was no set pattern of just accepting leadership. This just isn't the way it was done. Okay, let's take a quick look at the next judge who is mentioned in this account, because we have an insert chapter in chapter 9. And at the end of chapter 10, we have an indication of simultaneous oppressions. In the end of chapter 10, we find that there is more than one oppression that is taking place now at the same time. The people of children of Israel have done something unusual again in verse 15. They repented again of having worshipped the wrong gods and have put them away. Wait a minute, I need to back up further to where the oppression started. I'm sorry. Without the light here, it's a little harder for me. Verse 6, thank you. The children of Israel did evil again in the sight of the Eternal and served Balaam and Ashtaroth, the gods of Syria, the gods of Zidon, the gods of Moab, the gods of the children of Ammon, the gods of the Philistines. Boy, they really did it up royally this time. And they forsook the Lord and served him not. And the anger of the Eternal was hot against Israel, and he sold them into the hands of the Philistines and into the hands of the children of Ammon. Now let's look for a minute. Where did the Philistines live? And the Ammonites are where? Over here, up off the map here. So we have an oppression coming in from the east. We have an oppression coming in from the west at the same time. So we've got certain tribes that are being afflicted by the Philistines in the southwest at the same time that certain tribes are being afflicted by the Ammonites in the east. So this is a simultaneous oppression. And so that's why we date Jephthah and Samson to the same period of time. And we'll take up Samson later on when we deal with the Philistines more particularly. But we have a simultaneous oppression. From the southwest, the Philistines are oppressing Dan and Judah and Simeon. And from the east, the children of Israel are being oppressed by the Ammonites. But who specifically is being oppressed by the Ammonites? Notice it says here in verse 15, the children of Israel said, "We have sinned." Well, which ones are involved in putting away these gods now? Notice in verse 17, that the children of Ammon were gathered together and encamped in Gilead. And the children of Israel assembled themselves together and encamped in Mizpah. Does that mean all the tribes suddenly sent their representatives up there to Mizpah and Gilead? Not really. The next verse clarifies it. It was the people and princes of Gilead who were assembled there. And so you have here a very specific illustration of the use of the term children of Israel in a less than all-inclusive way. That you really only have a portion. You just have one area which is gathered together. But they are children of Israel, and so they can be described that way, as opposed to the Ammonites. So this is the only portion of the children of Israel that are gathered together, these people and princes of Gilead. And they say, look, we've got a problem. The Ammonites are ready to go into action against us. Where is the man who will be our leader to fight against the children of Ammon? We need a leader. And whoever will assume the responsibility, he shall be head over all the inhabitants of Gilead. Now, they are looking for somebody to take charge and relieve them of this oppression. Here we have the area of Gilead, jointly occupied by Manasseh and Gad. And we're looking now eastward across the Jordan Valley to the area of Gilead today. We're looking just at the western slopes of the hill of Gilead across the Jordan Valley. Further up there, it's a bit greener. And they were feeling this oppression, and so they had gathered themselves together and were now said, okay, who's going to be in charge of the army? Whoever he is, he will be our tribal head. We will give him that position. And it's sort of like they had, I don't know why I put that in there, had posted a wanted notice. Immediate opening, warrior to lead the army against Ammon, reward, head over all of Gilead. The problem was, nobody came forward. Nobody wanted the job. Even though there was a very good reward, nobody felt able to do that. And so what did the leaders of Gilead end up doing? We find here, in verse 5, that when the children of Ammon made war against Israel, the elders of Gilead... Remember, that's the portion of Israel that's being afflicted. That's why their elders go into action. Went to fetch Jephthah out of the land of Tob. Now, are we told about Jephthah? Backing up to verse 1, we're told he was a mighty man of valor. In other words, he was an experienced military man, which is what they were looking for. That's why they went to fetch him. But he was the son of a harlot. Even though he was descended from Gilead, Manasseh's son, he was not properly born. Or to use another expression, he was born on the wrong side of the blanket. That's the expression. And so he was not socially respectable. Now what I would like you to do for next time is read through this chapter 11, the first part of it, and notice specifically, after having advertised in this fashion, what it is they offer to Jephthah. Compare it to what they offered, you know, when they advertised. And then, notice what they ended up agreeing to after Jephthah was not all that excited about their offer. And then we'll talk about the significance of the difference in words that you will be stumbling across.